This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of December 29th, 2024. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 376. Happy New Year! The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. I award a virtual Nanaimo Bar to a difference maker. Highlights of former Premier John Horgan's provincial memorial service. And on the big deal feature, the MMA panel returns for a special New Year's edition. Goodbye 2024 and hello 2025. Mario Canseco of Research Co. and Andy Yan of the Simon Fraser University City Program are my guests. We gaze into our crystal balls and look at the 12 months ahead. This is the big deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Now, last week on our special Christmas edition, the MMA panel reconvened. Mario Canseco of Research Co., me, the other M. Mackin of the Breaker.News, and Andy Yan, the director of the city program at Simon Fraser University. We all reconvened to give candy canes or lumps of coal in the stockings of the rich and powerful. Well, we've reached the end of the year, and now it's time to look ahead. Look a little bit back at 2024, but look ahead mostly to 2025, which is coming at us really quickly. Now, just as a disclaimer, in 2024, we expected it would be Biden versus Trump in the U.S. election. We also wondered if Trump would zoom into the debates from a prison cell. It didn't happen. Of course, Biden was replaced by Kamala Harris. And, Trump is dealing with his legal matters one by one, becoming the president again in 2025 and getting that immunity that comes with it. For Justin Trudeau, we expected a walk to the ballot box early in 2024 instead of a walk in the snow. And I think we're now closer to the walk in the snow, as this time dozens in his own caucus want him to quit. And we also expected a BC United versus BC Conservatives vote split, which would have allowed the NDP to retain power with an even bigger majority. Nobody saw in advance Kevin Falcon quitting at the end of August and John Rustad becoming the opposition leader. He almost became the premier. David Eby, of course, has a smaller majority in a new reconfigured and bigger legislature. That's all to say that anything can happen. But sometimes we can be Simpsons-like and predict the future. And that's why we try. And that's why I'm trying again with Mario Canseco of Research Co. and Andy Yan of the Simon Fraser University City Program. Here we are at the end of 2024, looking straight ahead to 2025. And we're going to tell you, a humble Breaker.News podcast listener, what we think is going to happen. So take this to the bank or don't take it anywhere. So first of all, inflation remains high. Interest rates are cut. The loonie, though, has fallen. The loonie has fallen below 70 cents. How low will the loonie go in 2025? Are we looking at a similar path that we saw in the 1990s? Are we going to go down to 60 cents? First on that, we'll go to Andy Yan.
Well, I think seeing the loonie fall and it doesn't seem to be able to get up, I think is really, I think, elemental towards, I think, some ongoing challenges towards what that really means. And I think what that really means is actually really pressure on inflation in terms of inflation going up because of really how much goods are brought from abroad to support our lifestyles here in Canada. And I think that what that means, I think, could very well perhaps it kind of be a reconsideration, particularly if interest rates and currencies for interest rates, especially if the currency keeps on going down and the inflation rises, is perhaps interest rates at minimum remaining flat or possibly going up, which I think has some really profound challenges towards the attempts at housing affordability, because that's, of course, also attached to this key question. So I think that this is really, I think, one of those times that are incredibly precarious and kind of gray in terms of prediction because of, I think, what is happening not only in Canada, but then also to the United States. And I think that this is really, I think, a chance that it could very well, I think, go down to 60 cent dollars, which was kind of when I went to the US to study, and I just had a lot of sandwiches.
Mario Canseco, how low will the loonie go in 2025? The loonie now that we're showing up in our pockets, the new edition with King Charles the Third on one side, the Chuck Buck. How low will the Chuck Buck go if the Chuck Buck knows where the Chuck Buck can go in 2025?
Probably mid-60s. One of my memories coming here as a student, now that Andy was talking about his time in the US, when I came here as a student, some of the stores near Canada Place that were geared towards attracting people who are coming here on the cruises would have those billboards that said a Canadian dollar is 65 American cents. And I hope they didn't throw them away because we're getting very close to that type of situation. It's definitely something that is problematic from the standpoint of what it means to the country. We had a moment a few years ago where parity was there, where actually the Canadian dollar was more powerful than the American dollar, and it was the sense of pride among Canadians. We're doing better than the Americans. We're in a situation with federal political instability, a lot of concerns about what is going to happen with Donald Trump, and you add a loonie that is going to be at 64 cents at some point, conceivably. It's going to be tough on a lot of Canadians. It's going to be more like, will you still need me? Will you still feed me when the Canadian dollar is at 64?
And 64 in 2025. 2025, we're going into a federal election year. It's got to happen sometime in 2025, by the fall at the latest. It could happen much sooner, though. And Justin Trudeau's future, of course, is looking bleaker and bleaker. And it looks more and more like someone else will lead the federal Liberals in 2025. Who will that be, Mario Canseco? Who is your bet to become the new leader of the federal Liberals in 2025 to take the party into the election and to try to salvage what it has?
If we go with tradition, I think it'll be Chrystia Freeland. You need somebody who's not from Quebec. You need somebody who's well known. Having a woman in charge is going to be very special for the Liberal Party. I think it'll essentially provide a very interesting contrast with what we're going to be seeing out of the Conservatives. It's also something that might help when it comes to the recruitment of candidates. We know just how poorly the Liberal Party did in 2011 under Michael Ignatieff. They only got 2 seats in BC. They got 18% of the vote nationally. Certainly not the kind of situation that you want to see repeated, especially for a government that is in place right now. So I think what they need to do in order for this to be successful or to salvage whatever they can is to have an actual national conversation, not just a leadership where you go from hotel to hotel and from boardroom to boardroom trying to talk about what you want to do, but ultimately have a national conversation about where the country has to go, particularly with Donald Trump in the United States and the type of Canada that that most Canadians would like to see happening, unless there's a concerted exercise to connect with the population at a larger level and not just say, here is your new prime minister. It's going to be very difficult for the Liberals to hold on to government.
Andy Yan.
I agree with Mario. I think that it's going to be perhaps it is going to be Chrystia Freeland, but then at the same time it could also be set up to a Kim Campbell. I think we had previously been talking about a Kim Campbell scenario where very much you have the first female prime minister in Canadian history just to lead to one of the largest, I think, electoral defeats in federal history. And I think that this is really one through which I think is going to be at a time through which we need that federal leadership, certainly with our relationships to the United States, but yet fundamentally what's going to happen globally, whether, and the fact is the Canadian, I think, position globally is incredibly diminished. I mean, we are so far away from, I think, the views of that kind of heyday of Lester Pearson, of really this kind of every the world needs a little more Canada, I think, is what Bono said about in about the mid-aughts. But I think that the world has in one way kind of moved on, which is incredibly disconcerting. I think that really what our relationships with India, with China, with I think key trading partners, just as our primary trading partner is really talking about an America First policy. But then of course one also has to keep in mind that that relationship was already I think under pressure. One has to keep within the discussion of softwood lumber tariffs. It actually doubled in the summer. It's now up at 18%, 18.5%. So that really I think that this is I think somewhere where we are going to be in need of strong federal leadership. And I think that it's ambiguous to see where it's going to come from, just given where we are at this moment.
Now, in 2025, the G7 presidency is Canada's. It rotates among the members, and 2025 is that special year where Canada hosts the G7 summit. It'll be in Kananaskis, Alberta, in June. And that might be the one big reason why Justin Trudeau is hanging on with his fingernails to try to stay as prime minister, because he really is the senior member of the G7 because of the turnover of the elected leaders of governments. And yet, at the same time, though, he's taking a beating from Donald Trump after taking that quick trip down to Mar-a-Lago on U.S. Thanksgiving weekend, and Donald Trump taking to social media, to Truth, and to Twitter to call Canada the 51st state, that Canada's got too good of a deal, that Canada needs to up its game when it comes to border security in order to avoid tariffs. Immigration and border security are major issues, were major issues in Canada already before Trump got back into power, or before Trump won the U.S. presidential election. Now, Trudeau liberals are trying to put the toothpaste back into the tube. Is it working? And will we get closer to becoming, as Trump jokes, will it become serious in 2025? Will Canada take steps forward to become the 51st state, or will there become a Canada First strategy going forward? Will Canadian patriotism, the red and white, maple leaf, will that come back into vogue after so many years of not? Mario Canseco.
Just a quick note on the G7. I had the immense privilege of helping Percy Newman with his book on Brian Mulroney. And there's an interview where Mulroney is talking about how much the 1993 G7 meeting is going to mean, because it's going to be Kim Campbell's first, and it's Bill Clinton's first, and John Major is coming. And, we're going to feature Kim Campbell in a way that makes her just the most powerful woman on the world, and she's going to win the next election. And of course, we know it didn't go that well. There's a chance to do something similar this time around. Do you step aside and you allow Chrystia Freeland to have that moment in the sun, or whoever else becomes the leader of the Liberal Party? I think there's a couple of complexities that are unique. One of them is sometimes Donald Trump will tweet things or say things or mention something, and it's the reaction that you get from specific politicians that really catches your eye. And it's been very interesting to watch conservative premiers behaving very differently about this. Doug Ford in Ontario taking the high road and speaking directly about certain things that he doesn't want to see, talking about retaliatory measures in a way that we haven't seen met by other premiers. And Daniel Smith in Alberta sort of saying, sure, we're open for business. We'll do whatever that you think is best. We've been tracking the sentiments of Canadians on where they want to join the United States. We do this as something that is more provincial. Would you like your province to join the United States? And the largest proportion of responses is always coming from Alberta, closer to 20%, sometimes higher than 20%. It's not a significant proportion of the population, Well, what makes this compelling is just how many young people are considering this. If you're over 55, you're more likely to say, no, we're never going to do this. You know, we're a completely different country. But you have people aged 18 to 34 who are consuming American media, who are watching American sports, and who are saying to themselves, hey, this could be a great idea. Why not? So this is going to be part of the complexity when we discuss these things. We are not a people that is necessarily flag waving unless there's something drastic happening. And there's a younger generation of Canadians who aren't as attached to the country and what it means as their older counterparts.
And Deanne, do you think there will be a rebirth of Canadian patriotism? Should Joe Canadian come back and give us these rousing speeches about our beer, our maple syrup, our poutine, the second largest landmass in the world? Is there going to be a rebirth of Canadian patriotism, or is it just turn out the lights? Last one out, turn out the lights. Let's join up with the Americans. I mean, what's going to happen in 2025 with national unity, with nationalism, in order to fit into this new world order where Trump is back into power? Are we going to have someone to stand up to Trump and spout those Canadian values?
Right. Well, I mean, when we talk about Canadian beer, I've also heard the joke that Canadian beer is like making love in a canoe. It's effing close to water. That I think this type of national chauvinism is not Canadian. I think that this issue isn't necessarily about Canada first, but it's my biggest concern is Canada alone. That this thinking that we can do this alone is completely against who we are as Canadians for almost the last 150 odd years, that we are stronger together. And yet, the kind of profound challenges of coming together, what are the themes that connect us together, I think is one of our biggest challenges right at this moment. There's actually a really neat book by Timothy Snyder on the title's called, the book's called On Tyranny. And he talks about do not obey in advance. And I think that this is really the danger that we have as Canadians is that with every tweet that is coming out on X, everybody join Blue Sky. That's my big advice. Go ahead and join Blue Sky. That really we are obeying in advance and we shouldn't. And I think that this is really, I think, one through which we need this type of leadership where it isn't about going alone, but it's about coming together. And I think at this moment where I'm wondering where is that leadership? Who is that leader that can bring us together as opposed to say that we can go it alone? Because there, I think, is very little evidence that Canada has been great doing things alone.
And speaking of blue sky, the bluest skies you've ever seen are in Seattle. Have you ever heard that song? Now, something that has been muddying our skies in Canada for the last several years, foreign interference. We're talking about, will Canada become the 51st state? But there's been questions about whether Canada is on its way to becoming the 23rd province of China, for instance. We've seen what the Chinese government has done in Canada. We've seen and we've discovered what the Indian government's been doing. There's questions about the Iranian government repressing its diaspora, and the Iranian government getting involved in backing terrorist groups that are part of the war in Gaza. Foreign interference has been a very big story over the last several years, and of course, the Russians fit into it as well because Canada backs Ukraine in that war. The Hogue Commission was supposed to have a deadline of December 31st for the final report. It got an extension by a month, so we're looking at the end of January, waiting to find out what the conclusions are, the final report on the foreign interference in the 2019 and 2021 elections, and also Judge Hogue's recommendations on how to improve our democratic system, how to safeguard a democratic system going forward in this new world order where so many countries and so many foreign actors are trying to undermine Canada and its democracy. Mario Canseco, what are you expecting from the Hogue Commission final report when it does hit our mailboxes at the end of January in 2025?
I expect it's going to mention just the way in which political parties have been compromised. And I'm not talking only about the way that campaigns are run once the election happens. I think this is going to get into the nomination processes, the types of things that political parties can do to get somebody who is compromised to run for them. My biggest disappointment is the scope of the commission, because we've seen provincial politics and municipal politics also become increasingly cloudy because of the presence of these types of groups, particularly the activities of certain consulates and certain people. This makes things inherently complicated. And, we might have a situation where a couple of candidates get told, we're sorry, but foreign interference might have cost you your job or your seat in the House of Commons. But this is happening in so many other areas of our lives, and it's not something that should be taken lightly. I don't think any political party that is meaningful is going to emerge unscathed from this. The conservatives probably are going to have a hard time reading this, especially those who have clearance to read this type of documents fully. And the ultimate situation is going to be, how does Elections Canada and ultimately the other electoral bodies across the country deal with something like this? Because it's not a situation that is going to make Canadians feel happy about things, especially when you know that in cities, in certain cities, the level of influence from a foreign government can be massive. And it's not something that the Hope Commission is looking at right now.
Andy Ann, what are you expecting from the Hope Commission? And do you think by the time it's all over and the report is released that Canadians will be glad that we went through this exercise?
I think that it will be curious what they will report, because the ongoing existing problems of trust in Canada. I'm actually looking at a report from 2021 from the Eidemann Trust Barometer for Canada. And even back in 2021, 50% of respondents talked about how business leaders are trying to mislead them, and 46% believe that government leaders are trying to mislead them. And really, how that is a wake-up call for leaders who really need to take action to build trust amongst their stakeholders, or they're going to fall behind. And that's in 2021. And I think with the Hull Commission, it is really how it was, I think, surrendered. It didn't look at provincial and municipal elections, and really how amongst the Canadians they leave astray is actually fundamentally those that are members of the diasporic communities that are left high and dry, that are abandoned by the Canadian government. And I think that this is really, I think, something that I wonder whether they will be dealing with this, because of really foreign interference, and many times begins in most in begins with these many diasporic communities, in terms of intimidation, in terms of forcing them not to participate within our Canadian electoral systems. And I think that this is, I think, really, I think, something that I think in one way we'll see what comes out of that, but whether there is going to be any actionable items and the political courage to actually make things happen. So I think that, and the fact that it's ambiguous both on the Liberals and the Conservative side doesn't really bring much optimism towards what will come out of that report. But yet, at the same time, one has a certain amount of hope that they will give, I think, a set of certain set of actions that will be made to happen.
Now we'll bring it back to British Columbia, to the West Coast. In 2024, John Rastad's Conservatives, they started with 2 seats and they ended with 44 after their performance in the October 19th provincial election. David Eby's NDP stays in power, but it fell from 55 seats to 47 in this new 93-seat legislature. The Greens, they stay at 2. However, Sonia Furstenow, she tried to change ridings. She gambled and she lost. She's no longer the MLA or an MLA, but she is still leader. She did a deal to prop up the NDP going forward to try to bring stable government for the next few years. She's not a fan of the Conservatives, of course. In 2025, though, there will be some questions, I think, about the leaders of each of these parties. And do you think we're going to see any changes? Will the leaders of these parties, will John Rastad stay the Conservative leader? Will David Eby stay the NDP leader and premier? Will Sonia Furstenow stay the leader of the Greens? Who do you think will be the first leader to go if we have a leader to leave one of these parties in 2025? We'll start off with Mario Canseco on this.
Well, the biggest prize is being the leader of the BC Conservatives. I think that makes Rostev the number one target in this particular scenario. Memories of the first election where Stephen Harper formed the government back in 2006, and a lot of the social conservatives in the party were very loudly discussing in Ottawa plans to recriminalize abortion and ban same-sex marriage and have all of these discussions that they wanted. And Stephen Harper very quickly and very swiftly said, no, we're not going to turn into a party that is going to look into people as being inferior to us or being inherently different. And we're going to focus on fiscal conservatism and try to get this show going. And ultimately, he won another minority and a majority. Rostad is facing the same type of situation right now. The wing of the party that is completely anti-woke, and they want to. It's weird. It's like the anti-cancel people trying to cancel people who are trying to cancel people, if that makes any sense at all. But that is precisely what this is about. And you have certain elements within the caucus who would be willing to say, I think I can take this party to the next level. We came very close to winning this election. We didn't do it because there were moments in which Rostad could have changed some candidates or said something differently. You have people like Gavin Dew or Eleanor Sturco who would be very capable of raising their hands and saying, I want to take this party to the next level. And this is part of what is creating this situation where you have 15 conceivably backbenchers essentially saying to Jon Rostad, put Eleanor Sturco in her place. We don't have this type of thing just 3 months after the election. This is completely uncharted territory, but it shows just how complex the leadership of this party will be, because it's not a situation where you have specific assets. Yes, a lot of people voted for you. You were the only option on the center right, but there's no coherence as to where this party can go. And it doesn't ultimately matter in a place like BC, especially when you look at what happened with BC United.
Andy Ann, who do you think is safe and who do you think is not safe when it comes to leaders of BC's three big parties? Do you think by the end of 2025 we will have a new Conservative, new NDP, or a new Greens leader?
Oh, to be a fly in the caucus rooms of all three parties and to kind of hear what could happen and what may and what and what and what will happen. I do have to agree with Mario is that I think Jon Rostad is perhaps the most precarious, just given I think what just happened within 3 months of 13 BC Conservative MLAs writing a letter saying talking about really the need to restore confidence in core values of the Conservative caucus, really singling out Ellen Storkall. And I think that this is, I think, really talking about the kind of fragmentation that that is happening in the conservative BC conservatives, that it was perhaps one of those accidental parties that came around in after the announcement that BC United would not be running, that they became the accidental front runner and they came within a whisper of forming government. But yet I think now comes, I think, the aftermath, I think, through which I think that the question will be whether Rustad can build a team and whether he'll be leading that team into the next election 4 years from now. But yet I think that it's going to be interesting to kind of see what's going to happen within the BC Conservative Party, because given the kind of diversity of candidates, some of them with I think strong experience in terms of what it takes to work together and to be a provincial party, while others I think were perhaps kind of had the kind of response of I won in terms of in terms of what happened during the provincial election. So I think it really much is perhaps Jon Rostad perhaps that will see the biggest challenges ahead towards being leader in 2025.
And finally, comes to the end with the last major question, which is about just governments in general. They've all expanded, they've all gotten bigger, federal, provincial, municipal, regional. Everywhere you look, our governments are bigger, spending more than they ever have before, taxing people, charging fees, and of course, questions about the quality and the quantity of the services they give back to us. They're always making a lot of promises to try to say they're going to give money back to us. But here we are coming into 2025, The question I have for you is, are we going in this era of big deficits and high taxes and questions about quality and quantity of the services from every level of government, are we going to see a tax revolt? Are we going to see an organized campaign, maybe partisan, maybe nonpartisan, that is going to see people in the streets saying enough is enough? Affordability is a big issue. Mario, in your polls, that's what has been a common theme for the last several years, and politicians seem to be giving lip service to it. But are we going to see it manifest into something different, where people are going to get out there and pitchforks and shovels or other implements, and organize? And maybe a new political movement might spring out of it. Will we see 2025 as the year that the tipping point is reached and the citizens get angry and get on the streets? Is tax revolt 2025? Anyone? Start off with you, Mario Canseco.
It's possible, but I think the nuance is going to be on who is the most creative to try to turn this around. Pierre Poilievre has tried with the carbon tax. We know that isn't the one thing that is making Canadians not able to afford their payments or meet their mortgage commitments. But it's a fancy way of explaining it as something that Justin Trudeau did, and I'm going to take it away, and it's a tax. So it kind of connects all the dots. To make it something that is palatable for his followers. I think there's a difference here. And part of what we saw during the pandemic was everybody was scared, everybody was worried. The cities were worried that people weren't going to be pay their taxes. Corporations started to figure out what was going to happen with them. And we spent and spent and spent because it was necessary. It was a way to stimulate the economy. And governments everywhere have grown accustomed to this. And unless there's somebody who decides to do things a little bit differently, we're not going to have this type of reaction from the opposition. I think we have a great example of what this means in the recent BC election, where the criticism towards the high spending David Eby is massive during the first 3 weeks. And then the deficit proposed by the BC Conservatives is a couple of billion higher than the deficit proposed by the NDP. So I think there's an opportunity to connect, but parties are actually being very sincere about the situation that their own provinces are facing. And it's not the same as what happened, for instance, during the Mulroney years when they were tinkering with the pensions and they had all of those ladies from everywhere showing up at the doorstep of the prime minister complaining and saying that they took their money. I don't think it's going to be something similar to this, but we shall see.
Andy Yan, tax revolt, yes or no, in 2025?
I think probably no. I think a lot of this is, I think, deficit to what end? That I think that this is really, I think, missing the entire. I mean, that this is what was missing in the provincial election on both sides, really a honest discussion around economic development, much less economic development beyond, say, working for the government. Well, actually, technically, I work for the government. That I think that part of this is really understanding where that money is going to, and does that build innovation? Does that build wealth? Does that increase the economic well-being of the country, of the province? And I think this was completely missing is really the kinds of economic policies we need to encourage entrepreneurism, to really deal with diversification within our export markets. If we weren't so dependent on the Americans in our exports and really the kind of staples trap that we've been in for the last 60 years in this country, actually probably almost the entire existence of this country, where we're dependent on just the export of raw resources, that we, I think, are in one, I think, moment through which we are touching upon the kind of profound challenges of economic development, and yet it is very it's not talked about in public discourse about what that actually means and the kinds of strategic cuts and investments we have to do for collectively in terms of government. Because actually, funny enough, you think about really economic development in the American experience, the American government actually, through its many different means of spending money, actually deeply is involved in its economy, through which I think we really avoid those really hard discussions in this country, through which I think we are now facing those. We really have to, I think, grow up and bring in those really, really. I think they're not going to be simple conversations, but yet I think an issue through which we will have to deal with.
And finally, as we get to wrap up, just a lightning round, one question, multiple choice answer. At the end of 2025, will Vancouver have a park board? Yes or no? Mario Canseco.
Yes.
Andy Yan, at the end of 2025, Vancouver Park Board, will it exist? Yes or no?
Yes.
That's it. We've got a consensus here that Vancouver will still have a park board at the end of 2025, but a lot of other things are going to change around the world and around the corner. And thanks again for joining us on the podcast. Our great guests, the MMA panel, always popular. I'm one of the M's, Mackin, and we got Mario Canseco, the other M, and we got the A, Andy Yan. Mario Canseco, of course, of Research Co., and Andy Yan of the City Program at Simon Fraser University. British Columbia said goodbye to John Horgan, the 36th Premier of the province, on December 15, 2024. Horgan lost a bout with cancer on November 12th. He was 65. Thousands gathered at the Kew Centre in Colwood near Victoria, and others watched online. John Horgan's son Nate played a song for his dad, and his younger son Evan gave a eulogy. Other speakers included former Deputy Premier Carol James, Horgan's childhood friend Michael Albarton, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, Lieutenant Governor Janet Austin, and Premier David Eby too. Here are some of the highlights of the memorial to the late John Horgan.
A combination of a wake, a celebration, and a funeral. But throughout, we gather today to celebrate the life of John Horgan, husband of Ellie, father to Nate and Evan, father-in-law to Daisy and Veronica, brother, son, son-in-law, friend to many of us, Shamrock fan, Grizzlies fan, Canucks fan, longtime advocate for the people of the Western communities of Victoria, Monty Python and Star Trek devotee, former Premier of British Columbia, and Canadian ambassador to Germany.
Say a gathering of thousands of the political elite of British Columbia in a lacrosse arena on a Sunday would be pretty close to his definition of heaven. I tell you, as a politician, and I'm sure it's the question a lot of us politicians who are here ask is, man, he left politics more popular than when he entered. How do you do that?
Mountains rise, mountains fall, time goes by. The sun makes its way across the sky. People come, people go, bones become ash. All of our days pass in a flash. Kingdoms rise, kingdoms fall, time becomes now. Look at the sun in the sky. People come, people go, stone becomes sand. I miss you so much. I miss you so much. I miss you so much. Now you're in God's hand. I miss you so much. I miss you so much. Now you're in God's hand. Thank you very much. I miss you, Dad.
Now, some of you may have been expecting a more traditional or formal setting today, but of course, John had something to say about that. It was about a week before, or a week after, he'd announced that he was stepping down and he was busy packing up his office. Protocol dropped by to speak to him, telling him they had a routine question that they had to ask. If something happens to you, John, after you leave office, Would you want a formal state funeral? John, without missing a beat, said, "Do I have to be there?" Protocol hesitated for a moment and said, "It is usually expected, Premier." "Well then, no thanks," John said. "Nothing stuffy for me." And so here we are at the Q Arena, one of John's favorite places, just as we should be.
In John's final days, family and visitors gathered around the bedside of John to bid him Godspeed by singing, "God be with you till we meet again." Let us stand as we follow Al's lead.
Live long and prosper, people.
This has been the thrill of my life to be the Premier of British Columbia. And it's with a great deal of pride that I say to those who are watching today, thank you so much for giving me this opportunity, British Columbia.
Well, thanks so much, John. Keep on rocking in a free world and doo-doo-loo-doo.
Doo-doo.
Those were highlights from the December 15th, 2024 memorial to former BC Premier John Horgan.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In the Mercury News, California nets large population increase in 2024, nearly returning to pre-pandemic level. The state's population grew by 233,000 residents in 2024. The Census Bureau's 2024 population estimates show California's population on July 1st was 39.4 million. International migration is largely responsible for California's recent population increase. In Kyoto News, ruling bloc loses lower house majority, Japan's top news story of 2024. Also, nearly 500 people were killed in the powerful earthquake that struck the Noto Peninsula and surrounding areas in central Japan on New Year's Day. And Japan's atomic bomb survivor group won the Nobel Peace Prize. In stuff.co.nz, "Hello, Darling" wins quote of the year, chatty cockatoo first non-human to win competition. This year, a majority of the other top quotes were from New Zealand central government politicians or world-class Kiwi sports stars. Previous winners have been impromptu wisecracks or slips of the tongue, such as, quote, "spread your legs" instead of "stretch your legs" by then Prime Minister Chris Hipkins, or "Paula Benefit" instead of "Paula Bennett" by the then National Party leader Simon Bridges. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In Willamette Week, over 22,000 crows roosted in downtown Portland last winter, researchers find. Crows outnumbered Portland State University students on campus in January by more than 1,000. In the Seattle Times, the remote work capital of the U.S. is in denial about its effects. Seattle has led the nation in remote work among the 20 largest cities for the five-year period from 2019 through 2023, new census figures show. The gap between Seattle and many other cities is surprisingly wide. There are still more than 500 vacant storefronts in the downtown core in Seattle. The lack of safety downtown and on transit may also be propping up remote work. In Crosscut, Washington lawmakers fight to keep public records hidden on your dime. How much has the legislature paid private attorneys to defend against lawsuits over its use of, quote, legislative privilege? According to public records, the legislature paid Summit Law Group over $150,000 between February 2023 and April 2024 to defend their use of legislative privilege in order to continue shielding documents previously obtainable through public records requests. It has been nearly 2 years since the public was made aware of Washington lawmakers trying to hide their records under the guise of privilege. And for year-end news around British Columbia, check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for year-end reviews. That's Cascadia calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate. Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to first responders, police, fire, and ambulance, doctors, nurses, road maintenance crews, power and telecom technicians, grocery store workers, restaurant cooks and servers, the people that keep things going during the holidays, the people that don't get to spend much time at home, if at all. Thank you for your service. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of December 29th, 2024, the last podcast of 2024. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 29th of December in 1989, Václav Havel, a writer and dissident who led the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia, was elected the country's first post-communist president? Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca and introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Visit me there too. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News as news happens on X, formerly Twitter, and you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com. Until next week, Happy New Year! Should all of our protests be forgotten now? About to